This is Missy Martinez Stone, and you're listening to The Centered Podcast, where we have unifying conversations on the divisive subject of abortion. Hi, and welcome to The Centered Podcast. I'm your host, Missy Martinez Stone, President and CEO of the Center for Client Safety. And I'm so glad you're joining us today. We're finally getting back into the rhythm of releasing podcasts again, but we have a lot to get through today, a lot to cover. So we're just going to jump right in. I am talking to my good friend, John Mice. He's the CEO of Americans United for Life. We'll hear from John the powerful work that Americans United for Life is doing. He's the president, or is it president and CEO or just CEO?
Just CEO, Missy.
CEO of Americans United for Life, where he leads the charge in advancing the human right to life through culture, law, and policy. Before joining AUL, he served as executive vice president at the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, raising millions for patient advocacy. He's also worked across the healthcare sector and currently serves on the board of Mental Health America. He and his wife, Stephanie, live in Virginia with their four kids and have been foster parents for over a decade. John, welcome to the Centered Podcast.
Yeah, Missy, thanks for having me today. I'm really excited for the conversation. We've got a lot to discuss today, and it's a real blessing to have the opportunity to come together and bring light to oftentimes dark places in this world. So I'm excited for the conversation today.
Yeah, we've been trying to do this for a while. We finally got our schedules to sync up. But one of the reasons, particularly I'm excited about this conversation, is because I love that your story is kind of you have an unexpected path, right, to becoming the CEO of AUL. You weren't coming from the traditional pro-life world. So I would tell us a little bit about that journey of how did you find yourself leading one of the most influential pro-life policy organizations in the country from Crohn's and colitis and your background in healthcare?
Yeah, you hit it spot on, Missy. It's kind of it was an interesting path, but it's been grounded in my faith, I think, is the most important reason why I find myself leading AUL. My background is actually on the for-profit side. I worked in healthcare and life sciences for 15 plus years and had some really interesting experiences on the for-profit side, but I'd always wanted to work for a nonprofit. And my last for-profit role, I was running a division of a life science company and managing large biorepositories of research samples. We didn't store IVF samples, but we stored a lot of research samples for use in clinical trial work and for transplantation of patients. Very interesting opportunity. But when I was there, We helped the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation set up their biobank. They had a large resource of patients that were consented to submit samples and other data to help advance the research of Crohn's and colitis disease. And when an opportunity came available to join the senior team at the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, I was real excited to jump on board because I wanted to work for a nonprofit. Yeah. And so I was there for 5 years and had a really interesting, great experience. We grew from, 60 to almost 100 million when I was on staff at the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation. I had entered into a season of discernment with my boss, the CEO of the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, around taking on a CEO role. And so I had begun a search and found the Americans United for Life. And I always say the story that when I was first introduced to the organization in the first interview, the board chair opened the interview in a prayer. And I said, wow, I felt a very strong presence of the Holy Spirit. And I've always wanted to work for not only a nonprofit, but a faith-driven nonprofit. And while AUL is not formally a religious organization, you could make the argument that most people in the pro-life movement are grounded in their faith, as was I. Faith is such an important part of our life. And so my path to AUL is quite different. I have a background in helping grow things. And that's why the board eventually brought me on, because we now have this need in a post-Dobbs world to significantly expand the footprint of Americans United for Life as we decentralize our efforts into the states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I remember, you know, when it got announced that you had joined AUL, and myself and I know a number of other people in the movement actually found it pretty refreshing that you kind of came in as a quote unquote outsider, you know, not in a bad sense, but because you weren't steeped in some of the politics or, you know, it's just like, oh, here's somebody who's going to have a new perspective. Because I think for those of us like myself who've been in this for 20 years, like we can kind of lose sight, you know, we just get a little bit tunnel vision. And so a lot of us were saying, oh, that's really cool that you're coming. And I'm sure there's pros and cons, right, of doing it that way. But I know for a number of us, it was like, oh, that's actually really good. Like, this is going to be refreshing. He's going to bring a new perspective. You know, there's not that history that could kind of bog us down. I think it's like it was the right thing at the right time, not just for you, but I think for the movement. And I know, so you started at AUL January of 2024. That's right. And so Allison introduced us because she started doing some work for AUL. She was serving on the board of CCS. And I remember her saying, you've got to talk to John. You have to talk to John. You got to talk to John. And we had that first conversation. I still laugh about it. We had that first conversation. It was a three-way phone call between me and you and Allison. And bless Allison, she introduced us. And then I don't think she said another word because you and I were just like, I mean, just we connected right away. And I think we just realized very early on that we shared a really significant core value. And that's the belief that if you want to make a real change around the abortion conversation, around the issue of abortion, that we have to lead with compassion, with nuance, and really with a deep commitment to building bridges. You know, you've been very open about your experience as a foster parent, as a parent who's adopted, you know, raising children with disabilities. And I view that very much as like the pro-life value, the pro-life view in action. And now you're able to take that into the policy space. But talk a little bit more about how like your lived experience has shaped how you approach the issue of abortion.
Yeah, Missy, I'm going to go way back. You probably know my story, but for your listeners, I was born in a pretty challenging circumstance. So my mom was pregnant with me. I have two older brothers, and her husband was unfaithful and left our family, literally left. I mean, just packed up and left. My mom, this was 1980, 1979, before I was born, she had the choice to make. Do I have a third child? I'm uneducated. I'm unemployed. I have really not much going for me in my life. I have these two children I need to take care of, a six-year-old and a two-year-old, or do I fight for this child? And she chose to fight for me. And, you know, my mom made the decision to give me the opportunity to live. She made the decision to go educate herself and became a nurse. She worked really hard through that horrific circumstance that she found herself in to rise above. And to give me not only the opportunity at life, but a fairly normal childhood. When I was 10, she remarried a man who would become my father. And Herm was a golf coach and a high school history teacher and a basketball coach and a fierce defender of public education. And also taught me the skills of independence and discipline and things that I credit him with significantly. Unfortunately, he died 4 years later when I was 14. Oh. And, you know, but I ended up taking his last name when I turned 18 officially. I had been using it since I was.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But
wow.
Yeah, I was born with a different last name. And my whole life, I feel like because of the experiences I had as a child, my whole life, I've had this unending desire to help children that are suffering. Mm-hmm. And my wife shares many of the same compassions that I have. It's why, you know, we've started multiple backpack programs at our kids' elementary school, because I just, the thought of kids not having enough food to eat is just absolutely mind-boggling to me. It's why we became foster parents and had over 30 kids in our house over a decade. We adopted our youngest. We have another child who's now 21, who just graduated high school, has pretty significant intellectual disabilities. We didn't adopt him, but he's essentially...
No, he's yours. Yeah.
He calls us every day and asks for money.
That's the sign of being a true parent, right?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, we pray for him every day and we celebrate victories with him and his intellectual disability and the challenges that he has. But it's just been this like unending chip on my shoulder and a desire to help children that are suffering. And I, you know, for me, and even it goes even beyond that. And I'll tell you kind of a story of our journey in foster parenting. When we became, and I think this might happen to a lot of foster parents, by the way, so if there's any foster parents listening, you might be able to relate to this. When we first began fostering, I held such a high amount of animosity and anger towards the biological parents. Mm-hmm. How could you do this to your children? And I'm telling you, we had children that had horrific abuse and neglect and things that just would bring anyone to tears, the things that we experienced. But over the course of our foster parenting, I think our hearts started softening towards the bio parents because the thing that we began to realize, and you know, we would get information on the bio parents as a part of being a foster parent, so we know a little bit of the history, and we would do our own research to find out as much as we could about the kids that were in our house. Mm-hmm. The pattern that was revealed is that oftentimes that dysfunction is cyclical. Yeah. And that the foster parents were literally a product of the abuse and neglect that they experienced as children, that they were reliving as adults. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so our heart increasingly began to go out toward the bio parents, not just to condone the behavior by any means and the choices that they made, but an understanding and a compassion for the challenge they had in their life. And I think that's, you know, a different perspective that I bring to the pro-life movement is that, I feel really badly, and I feel I just this like visceral like pain for women that have to make this decision or feel like they have to make this decision. Mm-hmm. And I think too often, I'm not undermining the sanctity of the baby and the human life because that is absolutely important. But I think too often we forget about the challenging world that the mom is in and the choices that she has to make or oftentimes is being forced to make. Mm-hmm. We don't think about those things enough. We don't talk about them enough. Mm-hmm. And it's really important to get to a better understanding of why women are making this really unfortunate, difficult, hard, life-changing decision.
Right.
And the more that we can understand that and the more that we can, as a movement, begin to really reach out to the women in that capacity. And it's not a judgmental perspective. It's a perspective, I feel your pain and I want to help you.
Yeah.
You know, that's one thing that's really drawn me to pregnancy centers and to maternity homes is because they're doing that work.
Yeah.
But the movement, I think, has something to learn from that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really rooted in empathy and a desire to understand. And yes, we can be, what is happening to these children in these systems is absolutely wrong. But you're right. When you take a step back and you look at most of these people are a victim of their circumstances here. And what is contributing to that part? I mean, our family is intimately acquainted with the foster care system. I have three nephews that are now all in their 20s but they are my nephews and they've been a part of our family for 15, you know, years. And they came in and they were, I think 9, 10 and 12 or something, you know, it is a hard, hard thing to walk them through. And there was a lot of frustration with their family, but you're right. It's like, we have to approach this issue of understanding why we got here in the first place. Right? Understanding why people are making these decisions, why they are making these decisions that are hurting their children. Because there are evil people in the world. Most of them are not evil people. They're just very broken and they're scared and they're confused and they were not taught the skills, you know? And I think, I mean, everybody can understand now after listening to you say like, why we're friends, right? Because this is the stuff that I preach day in and day out, especially on, I mean, our entire podcast is about building bridges. It's that posture of of, I don't know if inquisitive is the right word, but just wanting to understand, wanting to meet people where they are, wanting to understand the core issue, and then find results that are addressing that, right? Mm-hmm. Like that is a foundational piece. Like before, when I'm interviewing people that want to work for us, we do a pre-interview call and we go through the basic stuff. But one of the questions I ask is, can you talk about the subject with compassion? Are you able to be nuanced and show empathy? Because if you can't do that, I don't care how fantastic your resume is, you're not on my team, right? Yeah. It is so foundational to what we do. And one of the reasons why you and I connected so quickly, because it's just so refreshing and exciting to, and unfortunately, this is not the case all the time, to find other leaders that are like-minded. But I think, so we're like-minded in the values way, but then we found this additional layer of like, not only are we like-minded, but our work, or both of our missions complement each other so well. So introduce the listeners, if they haven't heard, like give us a quick overview of the mission of Americans United for Life. And we can talk a little bit about how not only are we like-minded in the value sense, but our works are so complementary as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Missy. So AUL started over 50 years ago. We've been around a long, long time. And what drew me specifically to AUL was this, a couple of things. The spirit of incrementalism, the spirit that we need to meet culture where culture is at, and do our job to move culture in a direction that honors human dignity. Mm-hmm. And that's not an easy thing. It's not a fast thing most of the time. Sometimes it does happen quickly. But that really drew me to AUL. There was an article that Clark Forsythe, who's been on our team for over 40 years, Clark is amazing. He is one of the brightest legal minds in the pro-life movement, wrote an article about the idea of both incrementalism, the spirit by which MLK brought to the racial issues in the 1960s, civil rights issues, combined with this idea from Abraham Lincoln that no law can get ahead of public sentiment. You have mm-hmm. to have buy-in from the public. And to get buy-in from the public, you need to make a very compelling case for the work that you do. And that's a lot of the stuff that we do at AUL. Our work is pretty complex. It is very lawyerly. I'm not an attorney, but our work is very much so grounded in policy and law. We've been involved in every single Supreme Court case that's come through the Supreme Court. Our work was cited in Dobbs. We essentially created the playbook in 1984 to overturning Roe. And it took a long time to do it. But we used, you know, a very methodical, incremental approach to eventually overturn Roe, and has brought us to this point in the culture that we're at now, where we've made some significant advancements. The government can no longer say there's a right to abortion. Mm-hmm. But it's now at the state level, which necessitates a vast expansion into the states. And you know, the other thing that I think is unique about AUL is our position in the movement. I look at our position in the movement as a convener of organizations. Mm-hmm. I've worked doggedly over the last 18 months. I probably had 50 plus conversations with pro-life leaders across the spectrum of the movement. And Missy, and I think it's so funny, like I've had maybe 6 or 7 conversations at the level that you and I had. And I'm creating what I call like a bench of very like-minded.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, leaders in the movement that see it very similarly and
yes.
aren't concerned with, you know, the taking credit and aren't concerned with their way or the highway, are, you know, what I find most attractive in a pro-life organization is an organization that says, this is our unique value to the movement. Mm-hmm. We're mm-hmm. not going to be everything to everybody. We're going to do what we do, and we're going to do it really, really well.
Yeah.
And then we're going to partner with organizations that do stuff that we don't do so we can ensure that we're all moving in the right direction.
Right.
And so, you know, and there's a lot of those organizations in the movement. Of course, there's always a couple that think that they can do everything and be everything,
sure.
everyone.
Yeah.
You know, but at the end of the day, a networked approach to the movement is what's going to succeed long term. It's not going to mm-hmm. be one organization solving all the problems. It's not going to be butting heads of organizations. It's going to be working together. Mm-hmm. And You know, so that's really important. But if going back to like the AUL, our work is grounded in state policy. So 400 pieces of model legislation have been passed in state houses across this country leveraging our work. And then at the federal government, we work both on the Hill, but also in the Supreme Court and in the judiciary, leveraging amicus brief to provide the constitutional justification for human dignity. Mm-hmm. We also, and this is somewhat unique to AUL, we increasingly have been active in the physician-assisted suicide space. I believe that that's an affront to human dignity, and it really puts vulnerable people at risk. And you know, yeah. Perfect example is to look at what's happened in Colorado. I want to say it was three or four women from the same clinician who suffered from anorexia that were given drugs to end their life. If there's any form of abuse and manipulation from a healthcare provider, that's it. But that the problem with physician-assisted suicide is it opens the door in that regard.
Yeah.
And then the last area, there's two others that we've really moved into. One is absolutely emphasizing pro-family policy. You know, as much as we can from a policy perspective, if we can solve the marriage issue in this country, we solve the abortion issue. Mm-hmm. Almost 90% of all abortions happen out of wedlock. And so, you know, what can we do from a policy perspective, both at the federal and state level, to address that? What can we do to help young families have and raise children? So we've been very active advocates of the extension of the child tax credit. We've been centrally involved in legislation that would essentially make birth free for all Americans as a means of leveraging the government to help support the growth of families, because it's become so expensive to have children. And then, you know, on the last end, we've become much more active in foster and adoption policy. They're also related. You know, my feedback to your listeners is, if you've ever thought about being a foster parent, do it. Leap in. It's not easy. It's the most difficult thing that I've ever had to do in my life. But my goodness, was it worth it. It was worth it not only for help build compassion in me, in my heart, but for my biological children to have gone through that experience. I mean, you should see them. They are the most compassionate kids you'd ever meet, because they've seen kids that have come from just horrible circumstances. And so, you know, if there's anything anyone gets from this, please consider being foster parents. We need more good foster parents. But that's essentially AUL and our work.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, where our work overlaps the most is the policy piece, right? And so, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about this, of you guys are looking at, on the state level and the federal level, not only a life affirming policy, but then, you know, policies that are making our culture, helping shift our culture and creating an environment where it doesn't feel so difficult to have a family. I mean, we have these conversations all the time. You know, I'm in my late 30s and I have so many friends who have chosen not to have children, or we're a one child household, because just the logistics of having a family with childcare and health insurance. Like when I had my child, this was almost 5 years ago, and I'm sure it's gone up since then, but it was pretty well understood that you're going to pay $5,000 to $7,000 out of pocket, regardless of your health insurance, whatever. Everybody told me, just go ahead and prepare. You're going to still pay $5,000 to $7,000 out of pocket to have this child. And for us, you know, at the time, we had no money. You know, like, that is a really huge expense. And then you add on to that, you know, the issue of childcare. Like, our culture is not family friendly. We don't have paid maternity leave. Like, most developing countries have it set up so that parents can succeed, right? We don't. And I love that you guys are pushing that forward, because it's not just about ending abortion. It's about, how did we get here? It's because people don't feel like they have the resources or the ability to parent in our country. But we interact the most on the policy side, because you help pass the laws and then we help ensure that they're enforced, right? And so we're looking at, you know, I'll give a good example of this. In Wyoming, did not have good policy on the books. It was very, very old. It was very vague, and it kind of created this loophole for this abortion facility to open. And once we identified that loophole, this is even before you and I had met. This is a long time ago. I went to AUL's website because they were like, a senator called us and they were like, how do we close this loophole? And I said, hold on. I went to your website. I pulled all of your model legislation on licensure. And I said, talk to these guys. They'll get you started, you know, and that was the beginning of that. And ultimately led to, took 2 years, but it led to Wyoming passing very good policy that, that licensed abortion facilities, and the abortion facility in that state was refusing to meet those standards. And so, you know, our work is very complementary, you know, in that sense. And we, and I'm excited. I'm like thinking about this now. I'm like just brainstorming. I'm like, oh, I would love to look at the enforcement mechanisms of the pro-family stuff too. I'm like, cause I want to make sure that stuff is enforced too. You know, I'm already like dreaming about, you know, what else we can do. So, I do want to hit, this, there was some really significant stuff that came out. So I'm just going to shift the conversation for a second. We have a really, we're in a really interesting place right now. There's a huge opportunity, especially around the abortion pill. I know we've been talking a lot about like post-birth, like family, but let's back up a little bit. So there's a lot going on with the abortion pill. And people have heard on our podcast us talk about this ad nauseum about how unregulated it is. And a recent study came out called The Abortion Pill Harms Women, and it's confirmed what we've been seeing for years, right? What we've been seeing on the ground level, how the chemical abortion is being mishandled. Complications are not reported. They're underreported. Women are left to suffer without support. Physicians aren't being held accountable for how they're distributing it. And you and I both dove into that study to really understand it, but you have an interesting perspective because of your background in healthcare. Can you walk us through the data and like what kind of data they use and why that is so important and why this report needs to be taken seriously?
Yeah, Missy, I'm happy to. So a couple things before I dive in on this data set. It's really what's really intriguing about this data set, and this has become much more, is better understanding how drugs work in the real world. So there is this emerging area within pharmaceutical and healthcare related research around what's called real world medicine or real world evidence. And essentially, it's once a drug has been approved, how does the drug work in a large population size setting? And so pharmaceutical companies are investing heavily in real world evidence to demonstrate, hey, not only did this drug work really well in very controlled clinical trials, it also works really well in the real world. Mm-hmm. And so that's really important to note on the front end. The second thing that I'll mention is if you look at the history of the approval of mifepristone in this country, it was initially approved in the year 2000. It was based on a number of small trials. There was only 859 U.S. participants in that trial. And when they initially approved mifepristone, they did it with a set of really pretty strict safety criteria, because really at the end of the day, there could be a lot of complications associated with that medication. And so when it was initially approved, you had to have 3 required in-person visits to first evaluate the woman for, you know, her gestational age, if she was ectopic, if she had multiples or any other complications that would prevent her from taking the medication. It was also required that administration and follow-up be done in office in person. It also required that physicians only were able to prescribe this medication, and there was mandatory reporting of all serious adverse events.
When was this?
This was in 2000. And it's really important. Mm. That last point's really important.
Yeah.
Because when you bring a new drug to market, and this goes for any medication, mm-hmm. and this is back to real world, you really want a really deep understanding of what's going on with the medication from a serious adverse event perspective. Because again, those clinical trials are really controlled. you know, they have a lot of exclusion criteria. They only take certain, and in the case of Mifepristone, it was patients without comorbidities. It was, I mean, and this is common in clinical trials.
Sure.
You know, it's very controlled. And they have to do that. They have to control because you need to be able to see apples to apples in a clinical trial.
Sure.
But you also have to see what happens in the real world. And that's why mandatory reporting of serious adverse events was really important when it was first introduced. In 2016, the Obama administration, and this is where it becomes super politicized. And this is really, really unfortunate. And the consequences of which have had a really serious impact on the health and safety of women. And that's what gets me real fired up here.
Yeah, right.
They reduced the in-person visit requirement from 3 to 1. They extended the gestational age limit. So when it was initially approved, you could only take the medication up to 7 weeks. Now it was in 2016, you could take it up to 10 weeks. They allowed non-physician healthcare providers like nurse practitioners to begin prescribing this medication. You still had to dispense in the office, but it could be taken at home. And really importantly, in 2016, they removed the requirement for clinicians to report serious adverse events outside of death, which is—
That's wild.
It's a total political move. It's total political move.
And just establish any other time somebody has an adverse reaction to any drug, you have to report. Like, this is a deviation from general standards, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And then in 2023, during the Biden administration, they used COVID as the excuse to absolutely eliminate all in-person requirements, which is horrifying with this medication. So now a woman can be ordered, prescribed this medication via telehealth, and oftentimes there's even apps that can do this where you don't even see somebody.
Oh yeah, they order them online. Yeah, they don't even see them. Right,
even talk to a doctor, and so now you can't evaluate a woman for her gestational age. She could be way beyond 10 weeks. You can't, and that makes for increased serious adverse events. You can't determine if a woman's ectopic. So several women have died. There's actually a case in Nevada that I'm sure you're well aware of. Yeah. Of a woman that died from taking this because she was ectopic and Planned Parenthood did not evaluate her for ectopic pregnancy. You can't determine if the woman has multiples. So the case in Alabama with Amber Thurman, she died because she had multiples and didn't know it because they didn't have the in-person visit. And so you have these complicated cases. And on top of that, you now have a certain percentage of women that are being prescribed this medication that are not even pregnant.
Yeah, they're calling it like advanced, preemptive.
Yeah, advanced provision or preemptive. They're keeping them in their cabinets for when they become pregnant. The frightening thing there is there's absolutely no
oversight
with the clinician at the time of when that happens. So this study that was done by EPPC uses what's called the all-payer claims data set. So when you go to a doctor, when you bill insurance, they list a series of codes. That's how they get paid for their work and with the insurance company. These are standardized codes across medicine. And so EPPC took a look at what's called the all-payer claims data set. And this includes every single insurance claim, Medicare claim, Medicaid claim, and TRICARE claim from 2017 to 2023. It's a really, really—
I mean, we're talking millions upon millions.
Probably in the Bs, probably billions. Because keep in mind, I mean, this is every claim. It's not just abortion related. It's every medical claim. And so every time you go to that, I mean, sometimes you go and you have— there'd be 10 different things it's done. So we're talking billions.
Out of, wow.
The other interesting thing, all pharmaceutical companies and the government have the same exact data set. So it's not like they cherry picked some like secretive data set that they could essentially cherry pick the data and share an outcome that they wanted to get to. What the data showed was a 22% or 22 times a likelihood of a serious adverse event. So their data exposed, so the way that the data works is that it's de-identified. So we don't know who the patient is, but we can follow that patient over time. And we can see, did that patient who was prescribed mifepristone and billed insurance, did they show up in the ER within a 45-day time frame? And they used a lot of exclusionary criteria to remove women that didn't have serious adverse events. So maybe you showed up to the ER, you know, 30 days later and you had a really bad cold, or you had, you cut your arm, or
they wanted to make sure this data was as accurate as possible by being very,
And in fact, they threw out, I think it was 70% of all ER claims were thrown out of the data set because they didn't meet the criteria that EPBC had put in place. And even with 70% of the claims thrown out, they still had a 22 times greater likelihood of serious adverse events. And so what this gives us is an opportunity. It's not definitive proof because it's not a peer-reviewed study, but what it is, Missy, is a really strong signal. It's a very strong signal. And it should, regardless of your opinion on abortion, it should be like, wow.
Raise some flags.
We need to look at this. We absolutely need to flush this out, and we need to do a thorough evaluation. That's what this whole study is about. Now, it's interesting because the other side has very quickly attacked this as junk science, as the clinicians weren't involved, it was not peer reviewed. But at the end of the day, it's a signal, not definitive. What we're trying to do at AUL with this project, our efforts have been significant. We're trying to work within Capitol Hill and within the agencies to say, you got to cross-validate this data set.
Yeah.
They have access to the same data. They can do their own analysis using the same criteria that was used by EPPC to come to the same exact conclusion. And our hope is that the government, at a minimum, will reinstate the safety measures to keep women safe. So that's the efforts that are ongoing on our end.
Yeah. And what I've said is, so we reinstate the safety regulations. So what are they going to be enforced? Because we have had, before Biden pulled back, the REMS, what's REMS stand for? I'm trying to remember.
Risk evaluation measure.
Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. So the FDA creates REMS, and that they create guides for medication. And these REMS are what doctors have to adhere to when they're prescribing this medication. And so we had so many physicians that weren't following basic, a chemical abortion REMS. And so we would go to like medical boards. And this is the stuff this is even the pulled back one, right? And they're not even following that. They did not care. They did absolutely nothing. And so my challenge is like, okay, now let's get these safety measures back in place. What is enforcement look like? Because it doesn't matter if these laws are on the books if they're not being enforced. So in a perfect world, okay, so the FDA reinstates REMS, puts the safety regulations back. What does enforcement look like? And that's the conversation that we're having of how do you document that these safety regulations are being followed? What does accountability look like as far as like what who is responsible for oversight, and what is the protocol for filing a complaint, and what are the penalties? There has to be real consequences to the people that are refusing to follow these safety requirements. And I'll tell my own story. I had a really interesting kind of brush with chemical abortion pills. And I could have it reminds me of your story at the beginning of how you were in a position where your mom could have had an abortion, right? Like it was like the perfect scenario here. I had a perfect scenario of I could have been a woman in the emergency room with complications. It was back in 2020. It was right when what was then called Reprotection was getting started. No, it was 2019. It was before Reprotection. It was before we'd even incorporated. I had already had one pretty traditional miscarriage. That was my first loss. And my husband and I got pregnant again. I was on Medicaid at the time, and we had nothing. And so I had to go to the local university hospital. The attending there was one of the abortionists in our city. And I knew her name because of the work that I did. And I chose not to meet her. I was very kind about it, but I was talking to a resident and she said, Dr. I don't remember her name, but she, she'll come in and say hi. And I went, oh, no, thank you. And she was like, are you sure? And I was like, I do not need to meet her. I mean, I was already in such an anxious state. I had a miscarriage. This was my second pregnancy. I'm so scared about having a miscarriage again. And the resident over, or the attending over our resident, is the local abortionist that happens to also work at this, you know, university hospital. And they schedule me, they do all my blood work, they, you know, bring me in. And I had said multiple times, like, I'm really anxious. I've already had a miscarriage. I had a couple, you know, chronic issues that lead to miscarriage. And so I was very adamant that there needed to be, I had a blood clotting kind of disorder that deals, you know, messes with pregnancy and stuff. And so I was very adamant that I needed to be closely monitored. And so I come back for our first ultrasound a couple weeks later, and we get the bad news that they don't see the baby, right? And so we're devastated. I mean, I'm sobbing. It was just the worst case scenario for me. I'm like, we've already been through this. And another resident comes in, and she's kind of very like cavalier, but she basically says, we can give you medicine that you can take home and it'll help you pass the baby, or you can just go home and wait it out. I knew at that point what it was like. You know, I'd heard the horror stories. Like, I knew the truth about these pills because they give them to women who have miscarriages as well. And so I said, no, thank you. I'll go home. And long story short, they completely mishandled my case. They had incorrectly diagnosed me. I had a molar pregnancy. It was not a, and I had two ultrasounds. I went to the, I kept going back and I was like, something is wrong. Something is wrong. They weren't monitoring my HCG levels. I was calling their office going, something is wrong. And had I taken those abortion pills, there's no, because molar pregnancy, they're basically a tumor, and your HCG levels skyrocket. Your uterus expands too quickly. Like, they could be cancerous. You have to have a DNC. Then you're not allowed to get pregnant for like 6 months. You are so closely watched. They missed all of that. They tried to give me chemical abortions and send me home. I said no. And thank God I did, because had I not, there is no telling what would have happened.
Yeah.
It would have been diagnosed correctly. It probably would have been incomplete. They wouldn't have been able to do the testing. And so it's like, this doesn't just impact, you know, abortion, women seeking abortion. This impacts women who have had miscarriage. This is, mishandling this medication has impacts that are even beyond the conversation about abortion. And I talk to my friends a lot about this. I'm like, again, regardless of where you stand on abortion, there should not be an entire arm of the medical world that is essentially unregulated, right? There has to be something. We have to find a way to meet in the middle here.
Well, it's like President Clinton said, I mean, it should be safe, legal, and rare. And unfortunately, we haven't lived in that world for a long time. And it's just been, you know, one battle after another in terms of helping defend women's lives and helping defend the sanctity of human dignity and human life. Yeah, it's a challenging time, Missy. But I will say, this is what I find very exciting right now. There is more synergy in the movement than I'm new to the movement. Yeah. But, you know, there are several things that I've been told where the movement is now swimming largely the same direction. Mm-hmm. You know, we're very much so focused on defunding Planned Parenthood. We're very much so focused on the re-implementation of these safety measures with chemical abortive drugs. And then we're also very much so focused on incrementally moving the needle towards pro-life culture in the states, which is not something that's an overnight battle. It's a long-term battle, but we're fighting the good fight and the long fight. But it's been a breath of fresh air to see a lot of organizations swimming in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say, yes, there is a kind of, to speak to your point earlier about how you're putting your bench together. There is kind of like a subset. There's like, you know, all the pro-life organizations, and there's a subset of us that's growing that are focused on not only we're all moving in the right direction, but we're doing it together. Mm-hmm. And we're focusing on the thing that we do well. And we work together. We check our egos at the door, you know, and that part is really encouraging. And I think the reversal of Roe versus Wade caught everybody off guard, caught us all flat-footed. Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to see everybody kind of figure, like, get back in step, like we've kind of found our stride again. And, you know, I'm feeling hopeful for the first time in a while about the direction of not only the movement, but of us. And, you know, finally, I feel like the movement is recalibrating and going, okay, this is how we need to address it. This is how we need to meet people. This is how we need to reach people. Like I finally feel like everyone's kind of got their feet back underneath them.
Yep.
But it felt very just chaotic there for a couple of years. So before we close, what we like to do with our guests is we like to ask what you like to do in your free time. Because I think as pro-life advocates, especially, sometimes all we ever talk about is abortion, which is so important. But I'm like, I want to humanize us leaders a little bit, that like we do have a life outside of this. And so, but the caveat is that it can't be about being a father or a husband, because that's a given. We know that about you. We know that about all of our guests. You love being a husband. You love being a father. So it has to be something outside of that. What, when you're not being a pro-life superhero, what is your favorite thing to do?
Yeah, thanks, Missy. Yeah, so two things. I really, really like to exercise. So I exercise almost every day, and I try to vary it up quite a bit. Do a lot of walking. This morning, I walked for 4 miles with my wife. And then the second thing is I am an absolute music nut. I love.
Really? See, this is why I love this, because I learn so much about people. What's your favorite type of music?
So I would say blues is probably my favorite. A close second would be bluegrass, but I like classic rock. I like jazz. I like classical music. I like Cajun Zydeco. I like Irish music. I mean, you name it.
It's very folksy. You have a very folksy flair. Okay. Yeah.
But, I, you know, for example, my son and I went to the Dead South a couple weeks ago, which is kind of a folksy bluegrass, but they have a celloist and a banjo in the group of four. It was awesome. Tonight I'm going to see Chris Stapleton, which I'm super excited. This is my
father. Oh my good. That's going to be amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah. So just a huge music fan.
Do you play music?
I wish. Yeah. So I have a guitar, but I'm not good. I would much rather listen to other people that are super talented than play. But I love just absolutely. Yeah. I've probably seen B.B. King before he passed away. I probably saw him five or six times. I've seen Buddy Guy, Eric Clapton, Bob Dylan. Oh, my goodness. And I used to go to a lot of concerts, probably why I have hearing issues now. But,
that'll do it.
Just a big music nut.
Yeah. Yeah. So my husband is, you know, is a professional musician and I grew up in a musical family. And what I have found is really fascinating is there's like a number of people you'd never guess it that are like classically like Lauren Muzica from Sidewalk Advocates. Yeah. She's like a classically trained like alto singer.
Wow.
She's been one of my best friends. I said, how did I not know that? Like same. I studied classical.
Wow.
Vocal.
Yeah.
Performance and grew up my entire life singing. And I actually, that was my decision of like when I turned 18 and I was like really discerning, I was like, do I pursue music or do I become a pro-life advocate? I mean, that was like literally the fork in the road for me. But it's really interesting that you find out these like things about people. That is so fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. Well, enjoy your concert. I know you have to go, so we'll just let everybody know where can we find out about Americans United for Life, you know, website, socials, where can we learn more about you?
Just go to AUL.org and you can find out all the information about our organization, all of the work that we've done and, you know, the voice that we bring to the pro-life movement. We'd love for folks to interact there.
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll let you go. You can go talk to your board chair and I'll close this out. Always so good to talk to you. Always so good to see you.
Yep.
We'll be talking next week.
Awesome. Thanks, Missy. Take care.
Bye. That's all we have for today. If you'd like to learn more about the Center for Client Safety and support our work, visit centerforclientsafety.org. You can follow us on socials at Center for Client Safety. You can also find me at Missy Martinez Stone. Regrettably, I am terrible about posting, but every once in a while, I'll get on there. You can find Americans United for Life at Americans United for Life. Don't forget to subscribe. Please rate and review. This helps us just get in front of more people. Express why you like the podcast. Encourage your friends to listen. And also, when you get your next bag of coffee, you can order it from 7 weeks through the link in our show notes. 10% of all of those sales goes directly to the Center for Client Safety. So, you know, so that we can continue fighting against the abortion industry, I got to stay caffeinated. I've already finished my first cup. I'm about to go refill. But 7 weeks coffee is fantastic. And one of our board members, Anton Kresik, started it. And they've grown so much. They do a really good job at making not only good coffee, but supporting pregnancy centers and pro-life work across the nation. So thank you so much. And we'll see you next time on the Center Podcast.